Everyone, for those of you at home, we're ready to start the proceedings this morning. I'll start with just a housekeeping matter, especially again for those people following along on the phone conferencing. I'll note that yesterday on our website appeared the list of the expert witnesses for both sides who will be testifying, including their names and specialties. And so that's available on the autism proceeding portion of this court's website. And I also note that the parties did give me yesterday further word on the expected, though not certain, witness order. Our understanding is that today will be the testimony of Dr. Heppner and Dr. Kennedy. Tomorrow we will have Dr. Byers, and Friday, Dr. Kinsborn. Those are all petitioner's experts. Next week, we will start the respondent's experts, and the expected order is Dr. Fombone and Dr. Cook on Monday, Dr. Wisnitzer, Dr. Fujinami, and possibly Dr. Brent on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Dr. Buston, Dr. Ward, Dr. Zimmerman. On Thursday, Dr. McCusker, Dr. Gershon, and Dr. Hanauer. And on Friday, the scheduled witnesses are Dr. Chadwick, Dr. Fombone once again, and on Monday of the third week, Dr. Griffin. These again are subject to change, but this is the expected witness order. Then ask the petitioner's counsel which witness did you want to start with today, Ms. Chin Kaplan?
It would be
Dr. Heppner. Dr. Heppner, okay. Dr. Heppner, can she take the stand at this point? Thank you, Dr. Heppner. Could you raise your right hand for me, please? Do you solemnly swear that the truth, the testimony you're about to give us will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Okay, and please, the counsel and witness, please do speak up. Occasionally we're having some comments from some of the people trying to listen in that it's a little bit faint, so do your best to speak up. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Ms. Chin Kaplan.
Could you kindly state your name for the record, please?
Erin Heppner.
And doctor, could you just give a brief description of your educational background in college only?
In 1994, I graduated from Yeshiva University, at which time I began working in a molecular diagnostics lab at New York Hospital, Cornell in New York. In this lab, I started working on PCR-based techniques and some of the techniques that we'll be discussing today. Then I moved to Southern California and worked in a pathology lab at UCLA, where I helped design a technique for in situ immunohistochemistry, looking at KSHV, or human herpes virus 8, in Asian lymphoma patients. I began graduate school at UCLA in 1997, where I got my PhD in molecular biology, and used many of the techniques that we'll be discussing today. I worked in a cancer research laboratory and studied tumor suppressor genes. Since then, I've worked with Dr. Steve Walker, who in a collaborative project looking at measles virus detection, RNA measles virus detection in patient bowel biopsies.
Doctor, the techniques that were described in the Ullman paper, are you familiar with them?
Yes, I am.
Have you worked with those techniques?
Yes, I have.
For how long a period of time did you work with those techniques?
Most of those PCR-based techniques I've worked with for over 10 years. Some of them are developed more recently, and I've worked on more recently.
Now, Doctor, you're here to discuss the Ullman paper with the court.
Correct.
And the Ullman paper utilized different types of experimental techniques, did they not?
Yes, they did.
Before we go into the Ullman paper, I'd like you to run through the different types of techniques that the Ullman paper cited and explain to the court how they are run.
Okay. Do I have a laser pointer? Or should I get a...
All right, and Ms. Jim Kaplan, let's mark this as petitioner's trial exhibit. I guess we're up to number seven. Okay, and I'll just note for the record that Ms. Dr. Heppner, again, will have some has some slides here to show us during her testimony, and we've marked a paper copy of those slides as petitioner's trial exhibit seven. So if you can, as you go through these, Ms. Jim Kaplan, if I see that the paper copy is marked with page numbers, so if you can refer to those, it will help us later when we have to refer back to these.
Certainly.
Please go ahead.
But we'll be discussing a number of molecular biology-based techniques today, so I'm going to give a very brief and simple overview of molecular biology and some of the techniques that specifically that we'll be looking at today. So this is kind of the central dogma in molecular biology, and we want to look at some of the molecule types that are going to be used analyzed in this study. We'll start here at the bottom of this very simple flow chart. This is a protein molecule, and proteins are important for carrying out all the functions of the cell. Proteins are specific, designed specifically for a specific function, and that specificity is critical. How are proteins made? Well, there's actually a blueprint for that protein. The blueprint for this protein is found back here in the genetic code of the DNA. DNA is this double-stranded helical molecule. It's kind of a blown-up version. We've now broken down the helix. And just for simplicity, I'll just refer to these things by their the letter designation. So the A's, G's, T's, and C's. And T's always bind to A's. G's always bind to C's. And this is going to become important, so I'm pointing it out now. So there's a genetic blueprint for every protein found in the DNA molecule, in this double-stranded helical molecule that contains these, what are called nucleotides. And these are the letter designations for those nucleotides. And the blueprint here is specific for a specific protein. And that's also very critical information. Now, how is protein actually made? DNA resides in the nucleus, the protein is translated into ribosomes. So there's actually this messenger molecule called RNA, and DNA is transcribed to RNA, which is kind of a reflection of the DNA. It's not identical to the DNA, but it reflects the information that is in the DNA. The RNA then is translated into protein. It moves from the nucleus to the ribosomes, where it can be translated into the components of proteins called amino acids. Go to slide two. Now, as I said, every piece of DNA is, every gene is specific. It has a specific blueprint. And what we're looking at here is a string of G's and T's and C's and A's. And this codes for a specific gene, which would code for a specific protein. And what one would be able to do is to look in a database, which just turn on your computer and look in the database and look for a specific gene corresponding to your protein of interest. And what scientists have been able to do, what scientists have been able to do is to use this information as kind of a blueprint, as kind of a fingerprint, like a detective uses a fingerprint. So if someone wanted to determine the presence or absence of a particular gene, whether it's a self gene, a gene that we make ourselves in our own cells, or a foreign gene, such as a viral gene, we have this information in databases, and we can look at the DNA to determine the presence or absence of a specific gene.
So, Dr. Heppner, just to be clear, is this database known and available to the entire scientific community?
Yes, it is.
And are these genes specific to certain types of animals and plants?
They're categorized by their host, or by the organism where they're found.
So if it's a plant molecule, it'll be found in plants, and if it's a virus, it'll be found within the viruses?
What one would do, if one had a nucleotide sequence, if they wanted to find out what it was, they would simply insert a piece of the sequence, so let's say this line right here, line four, you would insert it into the database, and it would the database would then tell you the source of that particular gene. So we tell you plant gene and the name of that gene if it has a name, and any information that is known about it. We refer you to any information in any database that is known about it.
And this is computerized?
Yes, it is.
And is it utilized by scientists everywhere over the world?
Everywhere, all over the world.
And is standard practice at this time?
Yes. Okay, we can go to slide 3. So there's a particular feature of that scientists have taken advantage of. So now what we need to do is say, how are we going to visualize this DNA? And this is the basis of the molecular biology techniques. How are we going to visualize this particular gene, this particular stretch of DNA in a cell? We can't just look at a cell and see it. We need techniques in order to amplify it or copy it multiple times so that we can visualize it.
So when you say amplification, that means that it's been copied?
Yes, it's like a Xerox machine. You're putting your template DNA or your DNA source in a copy machine, and you set up certain parameters, and we'll discuss specifically what we do, and you copy it exponentially.
Okay, so just like a Xerox copy, you put one copy down, you get two, then you put two copies down, you get four. Is that what you mean?
That's
amplification?
Now, the feature that we take advantage of, that scientists take advantage of to copy this DNA, is the feature of DNA replication. Now, this is something that scientists did not make up. I'm showing you what actually happens in the cell, and scientists manipulate this in order to copy the DNA of interest. So this is DNA replication. So here is our double-stranded molecule. It's not helix here. Now we just have it straight so we can see it better. The strands start to separate. Okay, we have a separation of strands, and this is separated by an enzyme called helicase. Then there's an enzyme called a polymerase that comes and sits down here on the leading strand and adds the nucleotides one by one along the strand to create the complementary strand. So when we started out with one piece of DNA here, we now end up, as this continues along, we end up with two pieces of DNA. It happens a little bit differently on this side, but really I just want to show you the principle that with DNA replication, there are specific enzymes that are used to replicate that one stretch of DNA.
Just for the record, we're on page 3 of the trial exhibit. Go ahead, Ms. Chinkapi.
Doctor, just to be clear here, this process is accepted within the scientific community.
This is the way that DNA replication occurs, and something that everybody knows about.
And there's no dispute about how this happens. And Doctor, when you talk about the helicase and the DNA polymerase, are those naturally occurring substances?
Yes, they are.
So the body just automatically manufactures it.
Those are proteins that exist in our body.
And the body knows when it's supposed to replicate.
Correct.
All perfectly natural.
Yes.
No dispute about the fact that it occurs. Thank you.
Okay, next slide, please. Slide 4. So now scientists, again, I showed you that slide about DNA replication to show you what scientists manipulate in order to detect our specific target gene. So this is a process called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. What happens? You have your double-stranded DNA molecule. Remember, the first thing we had to do is we had to separate those strands. We don't add a helicase enzyme in this case. We denature the DNA, which means we separate the strands using heat. So if you apply enough heat, the strands will automatically separate.
And that's what you mean by denaturing? You separate the strand by applying some sort of substance?
Correct. Now, in this case, we don't have the polymerase doesn't know where it is that it wants to start amplifying or start copying. So we have to jumpstart this reaction using these little things here in red and green called primers. Now a primer is a stretch of DNA that is complementary to the ends of your target. So this is the target gene right here. We separated the strands. Generated primers. Now, when I say generated, we design the primers, and then you, a company generates it for you. So you design your primers based on the nucleotide sequence of about 20 bases, and it is specific to this target.
Just to interrupt you. You said that you designed the primers to be specific to the target. How do you know what target you are looking for?
So that's a good question. So if you're looking for the presence of, let's say, measles virus RNA, well, let's not talk about RNA. You're looking for gene X. You know that there's a specific region within gene X that is important to you, one sort of regulatory region within that gene X that you're interested in. You have some idea roughly the size of the PCR product, the size of the DNA target that you want to create. You have some idea about the secondary structure or the folding of this DNA molecule. You have the database in front of you, and based on a number of variables, which we don't need to get into, you can choose one or more primer sets that would give you the gene of interest, the stretch of DNA that you're interested in, that contains the area of DNA that you're interested in.
So just to be clear here, Doctor, you know what you're looking for, and you tell the computer, this is what I'm looking for, and it brings up the gene that you're looking for. You're able to look at the gene as we see it on page 2, mm-hmm. Is that it? And you look at the letters associated with
right.
it. And you match up the letters.
And you say, I would like these letters to be represented in the product that I'm going to create, in my Xerox copy. This is the section of DNA that I would like Xerox copy. These are the ends of that section.
Okay. And then when you get the ends of the section, you say you develop the primers. How do you develop the primers?
So you will develop the primers by looking at those ends, finding a suitable region, using variables that are more complex than we need to get into. You would find the ends, and you would basically write down those nucleotides, and you would put it in your computer and send it off to the company, and they will send you back a set of primers that correspond to what you have written.
So this is
selected.
This is commercially available.
Commercially available.
Purchased from someplace else.
Correct.
That's utilized by any laboratory who wishes to seek this type of information.
Yeah, that's the standard way to do it these days.
Thank you.
So now these primers that you've designed that are specific for your target. Now there's one other thing that I want to say about these primers, and that is you need to be sure that you are amplifying what you think that you want that you want to amplify. That means that these primers need to be specific for your gene and would not be represented. This stretch of DNA would not be present in any other gene. If you put down a set of primers that was more promiscuous, or that would be more that would be found in other genes besides your target gene, your primers would not be specific to your target, and you would amplify things other than your target. You might also amplify your target, but you would amplify things that are also other than your target, and that would be a non-specific primer.
So, Doctor, when you say you're trying to a non-specific primer, when you're seeking a target, you try to make it as specific as possible to whatever you're looking for, is that it? And you try to avoid adding on anything that would be a potential match for that target.
So one of the variables that you use when you choose those primers and you send them off to the company is you take those primers, you take down the nucleotide sequence that you wrote down, and then you insert that in a database that cross-checks it across the entire DNA database. And what you would want to see is that it only corresponds to the gene of interest, and it is not does not correspond to any other gene in the database. If it corresponds to your gene of interest and not to any other gene in the database, you have generated specific primers.
So the computer does all this calculation for you?
Correct, yeah. We don't have that information in that. Okay, so now we have these specific primers, which basically kickstart the reaction. There's an enzyme called a polymerase, and this is a thermostable polymerase, which means it does not get deactivated by heat, because remember, we had a heat dip up here. So we have a polymerase, which is this enzyme that basically comes along and copies the DNA strand. Now it's copying along the DNA strand here and copies along the DNA strand down here, and we end up with, when we started with one double-stranded piece of DNA, now we have two pieces of double-stranded DNA, the end of the first cycle, theoretically. This is theoretical because it doesn't always work in that first cycle. But at least in theory, I want you to understand the concept, which is that you start with one and you end up with two. The next slide five, please. Now, we don't perform one copy. We don't do the copy in one. We do it multiple. We do it many times. In fact, we do a PCR usually on the order of 35 to 40 cycles. And what happens is, in the first cycle, you end up with two. Second cycle, you take each two and you make two. Third cycle, you take these four and you make two from each of the four. So this is called exponential amplification. So an example would be, if I give you a penny, and then the next day, I give you two pennies for your penny, for your penny. The next day, you have two pennies. You have a penny, I give you a penny for your penny. Now you have two pennies. The next day, I give you a penny for each of your pennies. Now you have four. So that's exponentially, you are getting more money out of me. So this is now exponential growth. So you started with one, theoretically, one piece of DNA. And by the end of the 31st cycle, you have something on the order of 68 billion copies.
Doctor, what's the reason for amplification of this multiple copying?
Well, I'm going to show you how we're going to detect it. And what you're going to see is that we cannot detect very, very small amounts of DNA. We need large amounts of DNA in order to visualize it. And there are multiple methods by which we visualize it, but you need it to be in greater abundance.
So this amplification process that you talk about, is that accepted within the field of molecular biology? Is this the method by which every molecular biologist utilizes to study small amounts of material?
Well, this is the conventional PCR, the solution-based PCR. There are techniques this has been expanded, but this is the classic solution-based PCR that people use. And we'll discuss some other techniques that are based on this technique.
And this is a standard that's accepted within the field of molecular biology.
Next slide, slide six. Now, we've amplified our product. Okay, we put it in the Xerox machine. We've Xeroxed it. Now we have 68 billion Xerox copies. Now, what are we going to do with that? Because all it looks like in the tube is just some clear liquid. Now we need to see it somehow. So what we do is there's this thing that we call an agarose gel. And this feels kind of like very, very hard jello. It's made of agar. And it's a very, very small matrix, and what you can do is there's little wells up in the top here. You take your DNA, you put it in the well, and DNA is negatively charged, and you apply a current, so it will run down to the positive pole. So now we have DNA up in these wells that's starting to run down in each lane. So this is a lane, this is a lane, It runs down at a rate that's inversely proportional to its size, which means that the smaller products will end up at the bottom, the larger products will end up at the top. It's sort of like running through a very small, very narrow maze. If you're a small person, you'll get through really quickly. If you're a larger person, it's going to take you longer to get through that very narrow maze. And now we still can't visualize it like that. We apply a stain called ethidium bromide, which intercalates, or basically inserts itself in between the bases, and under UV light, it fluoresces. So what we're looking at here are pieces of DNA that have been amplified by PCR. Now what this thing here is a DNA standard. It's kind of like a ruler. So each of these lines, and this is something that is commercially available that you buy, and each of these lines here correspond to a different notch on your ruler. If this is 600 base pairs, okay, 500, 400, 300, 200, 500, now you have some idea of what the size of your DNA is. So if all of these here run around this size, run right here, well, you look at your ruler, and this is 500, so it looks like it's running just slightly below 500. This would be 800, this would be 350. And what's important about this is that you've designed your primers, and based on the primers that you've designed, you know you have a predicted size. So the first piece of evidence that your PCR is specific and that it worked, that it's sensitive, it worked, is that you have amplified a product that is the correct size.
Now, Doctor, gel electrophoresis, is that a technique that has been utilized in molecular biology? Is it accepted the way you described it as standard practice within the field of molecular biology? Is there any question that about the manner in which this would be conducted? So it's accepted as the gold standard for in the field of medical molecular
biology. This is how you would look at DNA in the PCR product.
Thank you.
Okay, next slide, please, slide 7. Now, I'm going to take a little detour because the subject of the question is actually measles virus. I will not be discussing any issues related to virology today, but I do need to mention that there has been something slightly technically different, so I need to take a slight detour and we'll come back to the techniques. The measles virus is actually a single-stranded RNA virus, so our cells have contained their genomic code in DNA. Viral DNA is generally single-stranded RNA, which is represented here. And RNA, for various reasons, is not an appropriate template. It's not able to be Xerox copied in the same way. So we have to manipulate the RNA. If we want to detect measles virus RNA, which is what we wanted to do in this omen, what they wanted to do in this paper that we're going to be discussing, we actually have to manipulate the RNA slightly in order to be able to apply this PCR technique, the Xerox copy technique, to it. Next slide, please, slide 8. This RNA undergoes a process called reverse transcription. And what this is takes advantage of what we're attempting to do here, what we're attempting to do is to take an RNA molecule and make it look like a DNA molecule. It's a reflection of that RNA molecule, but it needs to have the features of a DNA molecule. It needs to be double-stranded, and there's one base that is different between the RNA and the DNA, and we need to have that base, that DNA base, inside this product. So we are now taking a single-stranded RNA and making it into a copy or a reflection of the RNA in something called cDNA.
So, Doctor, is it generally accepted that measles RNA is a single-strand RNA?
Yes.
And is it generally accepted also that it's unstable to study as RNA?
RNA is a labile molecule and therefore unstable.
And is it accepted also that in order to study RNA molecules, one must make it into a double-stranded molecule?
Yes. One must undergo this, do this process in order to study RNA molecules.
And so there's no dispute within the field of molecular biology at all that this is standard practice to study single-stranded RNA molecules. Thank you.
Oops, we're going back to 8. Oh, where are we? Yes, 8, thank you. So we take advantage of a feature of RNA, which is this poly-A tail, which is basically a string of A's at the very end of the RNA. And there's an enzyme called reverse transcriptase, and we use oligo-DT, which is a primer that, remember, the primer is complementary to the target. The target is now the A's, and the T is a complementary primer. And it binds to the A's, and the reverse transcriptase essentially copies this complementary strand, which is now complementary to your starting material, to the starting RNA. It copies it along here. Complement to the RNA. It now copies the top strand and displaces the original RNA. Now the original RNA is displaced, and we have a copy of the now called cDNA that reflects what was in the original RNA.
And Doctor, what you have just described, is there any dispute within the field of molecular biology that this is how what happens when the RNA is copied?
No. Slide 9, please. Thank you. Now, so that was our little detour, okay, because I needed to let you know that in some cases your starting material is actually not DNA, it's RNA. So now we're going to come back to the techniques that were used in the OMA paper. Now, if you recall, the last thing we looked at was this agarose gel, which is the pieces of DNA that were run through the DNA product, the PCR product that was run through this matrix. And now I showed you a more accurate version before. Here now we're going to look at a cartoon version of that agarose gel. Here's your ruler, your DNA scanner, and here are your PCR products. Now what we're going to do here, the goal of the Southern blot is to give us further indication that what we amplify is what we think we've amplified. The first thing we did was we ran it through a gel and we used our ruler and said, I knew it was going to be 150 base pairs. It is 150 base pairs. That gave us some information and that told us that we likely copied what we think we copied. Now what we want is more information. We want more confirmation that we amplified what we think we amplified, what we had expected and planned to amplify. The way this is done is you take this gel that you ran, this agarose gel, and here we're going to denature the DNA again. And remember, denaturing is separating the two strands. In this case, we're not going to apply heat, we're going to put it in a specific solution that separates those two strands. The strands are separated, but we're not able to perform this type of experiment in that gel, so we need to remove the DNA from the gel and put it in a filter. And we do that just simply by soaking them together. The filter like a coffee filter. It's called a nitrocellulose filter, similar to any other kind of filter. And now we have a filter that contains the DNA that was in our gel, where the DNA is denatured, the strands are separated. And why is this important? Why did we separate those strands? We separated those strands because we're going to take advantage of the fact that DNA likes to bind to its complement. It has a strong need for A's have a strong need to bind to T's and G's have a strong need to bind to T's. So what we're going to do is we're going to generate a probe. Okay? We're going to take a piece of DNA and add some feature to it that's detectable. You can do this with a radioactive label, or you can do it with kind of a color metric or a color response. And in this case, they use a color metric label. And this complementary strand we're going to introduce this probe, okay, this piece of DNA, this side here, with this detection. Now, if this piece of DNA, is designed to be complementary to your target gene. If this piece of DNA binds to something that's in here, you will get a signal. If it binds, it tells you that its complement must be in here. If it doesn't bind, it tells you that the complement was not in there. If you design the probe to be complementary to this strand, and you know what your target gene is, you will now know, if this binds, that you have amplified what you think that you have amplified, what you plan to amplify.
So is the Southern block a check on whether or not you've picked the right gene?
In this case, the Southern block was used to see if you have amplified the product that you expected to amplify.
And is the Southern block technique utilized within the field of molecular biology?
Yes.
Is it accepted as an acceptable technique within the field of molecular biology to detect genes? And is it widely used within the United States as a standard to detect genes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Next slide, slide 10. Okay. Now, there's another type of PCR-based technique that was used in this study. So if you recall, this is called TACNAM PCR. So we're going to simplify it here. This is now here, your DNA, okay, represented by the two marks. Now, you should be familiar already with the concept of the primer. So you have a primer going in this direction, a primer going in this direction. These are designed specifically for your target gene, and they will amplify from the ends of that target towards the middle, making another copy of that target. What TACNAM PCR does, it does add two more layers that are important. You also, in TACNAM PCR, you design a probe which is complementary to one of the strands. Okay. You have a primer complementary to the strand, a primer complementary to the strand, and now we have a probe that's complementary to the strand. Why did we do this? Because because when you, this probe is complementary to this strand, this probe gives off a fluorescent signal. However, it does not give off that fluorescent signal when it is bound to its target. It will only give off that fluorescent signal once it is displaced. It will be displaced only if your primers are amplifying this gene. It will be displaced as this primer chugs along the strand. The probe gets kicked off, and it gives a fluorescent signal that is read by the computer.
So, Doctor, the TACNAM probes, is it a more specific way of finding your gene?
Yes, it accomplishes two things. It is more specific because in addition to the primers, which are specific for your target, you now also have a probe that's specific for your target. And that probe will only give us signal, appropriate signal, when it's displaced. So now if you have a very small piece of DNA that you're trying to amplify, let's say 100 or 150 base pairs, part of that will be specific. So 20 bases are reflected here, 20 bases are reflected here, and certain number of bases are reflected here in the probe, you've now pretty much found, been able to bind complementary DNA to a very large percentage of your target sequence. So it adds another layer of specificity.
So essentially, it's eliminating the possibility that there's error or something else present other than the gene that you're looking for.
Yes, it gives a higher level of confidence in the specificity of your reaction.
And Doctor, is TACNAM PCR an accepted technique within the field of molecular biology? Is it an accepted technique nationally?
Yes.
Internationally?
Yes.
Thank you.
The other piece of information that TACNAM PCR gives us is it can give us some quantitative information, which means it can give us some information about the amount of DNA that you actually started with. The way this is done, and I will not go into great detail, is that the software essentially is able to detect the point at which the amplification is exponential. So remember, we have this exponential amplification. In the first few cycles, we don't actually get that kind of exponential amplification because there isn't enough target present. As time goes on, after 15, 20 cycles, we now start to get logarithmic or exponential amplification of your target. The more you start with, the more starting material you have, the faster this reaction will enter that logarithmic phase. So if we get back to our penny example, if I give you a penny and then I give you a penny for every penny, it will take you a long time to get to $1 million. If I give you a dime and then give you a dime for every dime, it will take you a shorter amount of time to get to $1 million. If I give you a dollar and give you a dollar for every dollar, it will take you less time. So the faster that it gets to logarithmic phase, the faster it gets to that exponential phase, the more starting material you must have had.
So, Doctor, just to be clear, is that an indication that the greater the concentration is, the sooner you'll see your result?
The sooner you will reach logarithmic phase, and the more amplified product you will have. And this point at which you enter that logarithmic phase, that you enter this point of exponential amplification, is called the threshold, the cycle threshold. That cycle number is called a CT, it's the cycle threshold, and that cycle number is important for quantitation.
The cycle number is a standard, is that it?
This cycle number represents the threshold at which you were able to enter enter logarithmic phase. And if you have you now know that if you have five copies, let's say, you will enter logarithmic phase at cycle 30. If you have 10 copies, you will enter it earlier. If you have one copy, you will enter it later. Okay, the next slide, please. Now you can also we're going back to PCR. You can also do the Ullman study. The authors of the Ullman study also did something called in situ PCR, where they amplified directly the tissue. So the biopsy tissues were collected, put on a slide, and the PCR reaction, in this case, didn't take place in a tube, but it took place inside the tissue itself. And you can, this is not from that study, but this is just an example, where you can get a colorimetric read. So the color represents amplification, and here there's no color, which represents lack of amplification. Next slide, please. And they also
so now we're on slide 12. Go ahead.
Special Master, just one question. Could we just go back to slide 11, please? Dr. Heppner, in situ PCR, is that an accepted technique within the field of molecular biology? And is that a technique that is recognized both nationally and internationally? Thank you.
Immunohistochemistry is the last technique that we'll be talking about, and this is actually a technique that's used to detect protein. This is not one that was used in great detail in the paper, but just to mention that this is a way to detect protein. Remember, the bottom of that flowchart is a way to detect protein in a particular sample. And this is not an example from the paper, but this is a step and this is also a colorimetric reading. So if you have a color, you have the presence of that protein. The absence of color in this canker gland represent the absence of that gene.
And immunohistochemistry is an accepted technique within the field of molecular biology. And is it practiced on a national level? And is it practiced on an international level? And when somebody says that this was obtained by immunohistochemistry, is there any question about the technique that's utilized?
Not in general, in detail. Next slide, last slide, please. This is slide 13. So just to show you where it is, how it is that all of this got started, I heard about the ileum yesterday in the small intestine. So tissue is extracted from the ileum. It can either be put on a slide to be subjected to things like immunohistochemistry and in situ PCR, or it can be stored in a tube tube that preserves the RNA for later extraction. The RNA is purified and tested for RNA integrity because it's a highly labile molecule. You need to test the integrity of the RNA, and then it can be subjected to the experiment settings. And that would be it.
Now, Doctor, this is a description of the techniques, the experimental techniques that's detailed in the Ullman paper, is that correct?
Correct.
Now, Doctor, when you reviewed the Ullman paper, how did you know that the results of that paper was valid?
Well, the first thing you have to ask yourself is, do the experiments that are used in this study, do they answer the question that you're trying to ask, that you are trying to answer? The question that is trying to be addressed here is measles virus RNA present in the bowel biopsies of this cohort of patients? So that is the question. Do the experiments that were chosen help address that question? Do they address that question directly? And the answer is yes.
Now, Doctor, in this paper, the Ullman experiments were PCR? Was that it?
So the first experiment that they used was this conventional solution-based PCR.
And that PCR, as you indicated, is accepted within the field of molecular biology as an appropriate experimental technique?
Yes.
And what was the next technique that they utilized?
The next technique they used was TACMAN PCR, which I described.
And is TACMAN PCR also an accepted molecular biology tool?
Yes, it is.
And did they utilize any other experimental techniques?
They used in situ PCR for detection of measles virus RNA.
And is it appropriate in the field of molecular biology to use in situ PCR to detect measles RNA?
Yes.
Now, Doctor, when they ran these experiments and you were reviewing the paper, how did you know that the experiments that they were running were valid results?
So, like I said, we first asked the question, were these experiments appropriate techniques? And the answer is yes. The next question is, did they perform these experiments properly? So, in order to first address that question, we want to ask, did they use proper controls? Now, let's talk about controls. So, controls really can be subdivided into two categories. There are controls for an individual experiment. So, in an individual experiment, you would have something that would function as a positive control. So, in the case of measles, VARs, RNA detection, and again, when we talk about RNA, we're really talking about cDNA because we've had to create the complementary strand, the complementary cDNA in order to perform these experiments.
And that's accepted within the field of
biology. That's accepted. So I might use the terms interchangeably, but really what we mean is when we're subjecting these to these experiments, we are using cDNA, but it reflects the presence of an RNA. Okay. So when we selected controls, when controls were selected for this paper, the first thing they needed to do was to see if they to use a positive control. A positive control is a sample that necessarily contains the measles virus RNA, the measles virus cDNA. Every time you run the experiment, that particular sample must be positive. If it is positive, then you have shown that your reaction or your experiment is specific for measles virus RNA. If it's negative, then there's a flaw in your experimental design. You cannot get any information from an experiment where the positive control is negative. The next thing you have to do is look at the negative controls. The negative control is a sample where it is necessarily where measles virus RNA or cDNA is not present. If the negative control is positive, there is either a flaw in your experimental design, like as if your one example would be where your primers are not specific to that to your target, or you have some level of cross-contamination where measles virus RNA or cDNA contaminated your sample.
So the positives should always be positives, the negatives should always be negatives, and that's how you know that at least that portion of the experiment that you're running is accurate.
Correct.
And so, Doctor, that you indicate there were two levels of controls. What's the second level?
So the second level are the experimental controls. So you have your experimental group. Your experimental group in this case was ASD patients with GI bowel, with this idiopathic bowel disease. And the GI biopsies from these patients, from this cohort of patients. That was your experimental group because that's the group about which you are asking your question. Your control group, in this case, were developmentally normal children who underwent endoscopy and the bowel biopsies from that cohort of patients. So your control group has to be similar to your experimental group, but differ by the variable of interest.
And Doctor, when you run those experiments at that level, how do you know that they're valid at that level?
Well, you're still open-minded when you ask the question. So when you ask the question, your hypothesis is that measles virus RNA is going to be present in the bowel biopsies of this cohort of patients. And when you run the samples, you need to run them simultaneously and be open-minded about the possibility that there might be no difference. If you see a difference, you see that the developmentally normal children have mvRNA present at a frequency that is different, statistically significantly different from the positive from the ASD group, then you have gathered information about the presence of RNA in this cohort of patients relative to its controls.
But how do you know you're not getting a false positive?
The negative controls within your experiment will function as a control for contamination.
So, are you saying that you run both the experimental specimen and the controls together?
That is standard laboratory practice.
And if your positives are always positives and your negatives are always negatives in your control, then you have a certain level of confidence that that experiment is valid?
Yes.
Now, Doctor,
when you look at the Ullman paper, were there positives always positives and there negatives always negatives?
Well, I can tell you what I see in the paper.
Okay.
If we look at, you kind of need to go through the experiments one by one to do that, because each one has its own series of positive and negative controls.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Yes, why don't we do that? So which one would you like to start with?
Let's start with the solution phase PCR, which is in figure 2 for those who have it.
So for the record here, we're now going to look at the article describing, we're going to look at the Ullman paper, is that correct?
That's
where. And for the record, I think it's in the record in more than one place. One place is at Exhibit 63, Tab U, I believe. Okay.
Okay. So if we look at figure 2...
Figure 2 is on the... Let me see. Yeah, figure 2 is on page 2 of... Well, what's labeled? Okay, figure 2 of the Ullman paper. Go ahead.
Which is... figure 2 is the figure for the solution phase PCR reaction. And what they show here is that they had a positive control that acted true to designation, which means the positive control RNA consistently performed, was positive. They also had a no template control, which is a control that does not contain any nucleic acid, and therefore is necessarily negative for measles virus RNA. And that acted true to designation. The experimental samples, some were positive and some were negative. So if you have a positive control that acts true to designation, a negative control that acts true to designation, you can now get information about the experimental sample. So that gives us confidence that the experiment is working.
And with respect to this experiment, was it working?
It appears to have worked.
And Doctor, would you go on to the next technique that was utilized?
Well, this next technique is actually kind of a subcategory of this technique because they use Southern blot to confirm the specificity of this target gene that they amplified. So what they now are asking is, we've amplified a product of the size that we predict. That's what we saw in this agarose gel. So this A panel within figure 2 is actually similar to that agarose gel that I showed you in our slides, and to the left is that DNA ruler. Now in panels B and C, what they did was, we should go back up to panel A. The left side, the first 7 lanes of this panel, are using a gene primers that are specific for a particular gene called the F gene in measles virus. The right half of this panel, 8 through 14, use primers that are specific for the F gene of measles virus. And this actually adds another layer of confidence because we're actually seeing two genes amplified, not just one. Now the southern blots in figures B and C are using probes that are specific either for the F gene in panel B or the H gene in panel C. And what this is showing is because we get a signal that we have that this group has amplified what they believe that they have amplified because they have used a probe that is specific for that gene.
Doctor, just to assist the court a little bit more, could we go back to page 7 of your handout?
Oh, okay. My handout, yeah.
Yes.
So page 7 of the trial exhibit number 7.
Doctor, this was a schematic of the measles virus RNA,
right?
Is that true?
Yeah.
And you were talking about the F gene. Is that true?
The F gene and the H gene. So
okay.
The F gene and the H gene code for particular proteins in the cell, in the measles virus virion. And those particular components are not shown here specifically in the RNA, but they are portions of the RNA that you see in that single strand. So there are different kind of segments to the RNA, and one corresponds to an F gene, and one corresponds to an H gene.
And they are both present at the schematic here.
it's not detailed on the schematic, but it's implied.
Okay. So, Doctor, after you review this technique utilized by Ullman, did you believe that the experiment was valid?
Yes.
Now, Ullman ran one last experiment?
Well, they did the TACMAN PCR, which is the summary of the TACMAN PCR that's found in Table 2. And they designed multiple primers and multiple probes to determine the presence of measles virus RNA and to get some information about the amount. Because remember, this is a quantitative experiment as well. So they get some information about the quantity of the starting material. Yes?
And Doctor, after reviewing the results of this technique, did you believe that the results were valid?
Yes, they used a number of controls, which are listed in the text. They used a number of controls above and beyond what was used in Figure 2. They used a no-template control. They used a control that did not have the addition of the reverse transcriptase enzyme, so it was basically RNA without any cDNA, which was not able to be amplified because you cannot amplify RNA. They used irrelevant target primers, which means primers that were not for our target gene, but they used a specific probe. They used the probe, but they did not use the primers. They spiked it with RNA, and they used a single primer and a probe. So they used multiple techniques to make sure that it couldn't have been caused by some other kind of technical flaw, that the results could not reflect some sort of technical flaw.
So these techniques acted as a cross-check on one another. Is that it?
The TACMAN and the solution-based PCR?
Yes.
Yes. The techniques ultimately give us the same information. TACMAN gives us more information, but one really does validate the other.
So it gives you more confidence that the results that you're obtaining are valid.
Yeah.
Now, Doctor, how do you know that you don't have a false positive here?
You don't have a false positive because your negative controls consistently act true to designation. And if a false positive would really generally, it would reflect two things. It would reflect the non-specific primers, or it would reflect cross-contamination. But if it's cross-contamination, your controls, your negative controls, should also be contaminated, because contamination would not preferentially contaminate one sample over another, at least not in multiple runs.
And is that why you run the controls every single time?
You have to run the controls every single time, and if your negative control is consistently negative, and it is negative every time, then you simply can, it is illogical to assume that you would have contamination in all your samples but your negative control.
So, Doctor, are you aware of any criticisms of this study?
Yes.
And what are the criticisms that you're aware of this study?
Well, the major criticism is that there have been labs that have attempted to reproduce some of these findings and have been unable.
And are you referring to specific studies?
There are two studies that I'm thinking of specifically. One is Ossal et al., and I don't know where you have that, and one is D'Souza et al.
Ossal et al. Is contained at Petitioner's Exhibit 3A.
Right, okay. And just for the record, that's the 2006 article by Afzal, because
mm-hmm.
there are more than one by that author.
And D'Souza et al. Is contained at Petitioner's Exhibit 63L.
F as in Frank.
L as in Larry.
Okay, thank you.
just address the criticisms of the Ullman study by just by Afzal et al?
Sure. Well, again, when you attempt to reproduce a study, you need to reproduce all the variables of that study. Now, if the study in question, the study that's being reproduced, the study is attempting to show that measles virus is present in the GI biopsy, the bowel biopsies of this specific cohort of patients, all reproductions of that study must use the same starting material and must use bowel biopsies from this cohort of patients. Afzal et al., they attempted to reproduce these results. However, they neglected to use the same starting material. Instead of using GI biopsies from this cohort of patients, they used peripheral blood mononuclear cells from ASD patients. It actually was not even restricted to ASD patients with GI disease. So it was just ASD patients looking at the peripheral blood.
So, with respect to the Afzal study, are you saying that it's not comparable to Ullman because first it used blood cells as opposed to gut tissue?
Yes. So, what I believe that they managed to do was
So they used gut tissue. They used blood cells as opposed to gut tissue. Was
correct.
And they also used autistic children, but they did not use autistic children who had GI problems.
It was not restricted. That was not an inclusion criteria for the study.
So that's a potential flaw in that study.
Yes.
Go on, Doctor. I'm sorry.
Okay. So while I believe it's what I believe that they've done is they've tested actually a different hypothesis. The hypothesis that was tested there was, can you detect measles virus in ASD patients, in ASD children, in their peripheral blood? And it's a reasonable hypothesis based on the Ullman paper. It's a hypothesis that if it's in the GI tissue, it may also be in peripheral blood, and I would like to test that hypothesis. And the answer was it was not either not there or it was not detectable. It was there but not at detectable levels.
Now, Doctor, you also mentioned the D'Souza paper.
The D'Souza paper performs a similar study using peripheral blood and was not restricted to ASD. It was ASD patients, but not restricted to ASD patients with bowel disease.
So essentially, the D'Souza group replicated the Afzal group. However, the Afzal group had two potential flaws in their study.
Correct. So, and may I add something?
Sure.
Actually, the D'Souza study shows that they were able to use the primers that were used in the Ullman paper and were able to successfully amplify measles virus from positive control DNA, RNA, or cDNA. So they actually show that the primers are specific. However, they were not able to detect it in their experimental samples because their choice of experimental samples was flawed.
So the positive that was supposed to be positive was positive. And that indicates that the flaw is potentially with the study population and not the primers that was used.
That's right.
Now, Doctor, there's been this question about detection limits. Is detection limits something that's standardized among all laboratories?
Can you ask that question differently?
Sure. When you're speaking of results and everything, can we correlate the results of one lab with another lab?
I'll try to answer that question. I'll answer that question by pointing to another Afzal study, which was a collaborative study among several different labs looking for measles virus RNA or cDNA in the same sample. So the same sample was divided, multiple samples were divided up into seven different batches and sent out to seven different labs. Each lab applied their own in-house technique to those samples, and the findings showed that there was about a 1,000-fold difference in detection threshold between different labs for the same samples.
So, Doctor, just to be clear on that, this one laboratory took this big batch of solution, is that it? And they divided it up into seven parts, and they sent it out to seven different laboratories to test. And when those seven different laboratories tested it, the difference between the seven laboratories is 1,000 times different?
True. They didn't use one sample, they used multiple samples. Some were positive and some were negative. The only people who knew which ones were positive and negative were the people who conducted the study. Those samples were sent out blind to these labs, and what they showed was that while the RNAs that were present in high abundance were easily detectable, the RNAs that were detected in low abundance, there was about a 1,000-fold difference in detection threshold, which means that while that threshold is what is the amount of RNA that needs to be present for my lab to be able to detect it. In one lab, that's X. In another lab, X, I can't detect X. In fact, I can't even detect it until it's 1,000 times X. And that would be the difference in those detection thresholds between the labs. And that reflects, most likely, it could reflect differences in operators, in people who are conducting the study, and it also reflects a difference in reagents and technical design.
And just for the record, looking at your paper, Dr. Heppner, I think that study you're just talking about was the AFSOL 2003
yes.
study?
Yes, my apologies. That was a different study.
Right. Okay.
2003.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So, Doctor, what does that mean when you have a situation where two laboratories are testing and they come up with different results?
That means that either one of the labs, that tells you if the first lab that found the results performed scientifically sound data, scientifically sound experiments, and generated scientifically sound data, that tells you that there was most likely something wrong with the ability of the second lab to detect it.
Doctor, during yesterday's testimony, Dr. Kreitzman indicated that you had been a member of a team that presented a paper at INBAR. And can you just generally tell the court what the substance of that paper was? Or
this was an INFAR abstract.
Yes.
So this is preliminary data. And the goal of this study was to create a highly reproducible, highly sensitive, very specific assay or experimental design to detect mRNA in the bowel biopsies of ASD patients. And what we did was we generated multiple primer sets and tested them for their specificity and their sensitivity. What we wanted to do, in addition to creating a very robust study, a very robust experimental design that hopefully ultimately would be reproducible in other labs, was we wanted to show that this RNA that we're detecting is vaccine strain specific. So we designed a study so that it would show a vaccine strain specific kind of signature in its DNA sequence, in its RNA sequence.
And what were the preliminary results of your study?
Well, the preliminary results essentially show that we were able to amplify mRNA at a high frequency in many of the bowel biopsies that we tested. And there were multiple primer sets, and they differed in their sensitivity, which we would expect based on what we know now. That's essentially what we showed. And we were able to confer vaccine strain specificity in some of those samples.
Thank you.
That's all of your direct for this?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Mr. Manosky, did you folks have any questions for this witness?
No. Yes, we did. But, Your Honor, I may have a brief moment to reflect my notes here.
Okay. How long are you talking about?
5 minutes.
All right, go ahead. We're going to take a 5 minute break here. Okay.